Welcome to The Art of the Impossible, a podcast for the design and manufacturing industry that explores how you can leverage technology, processes, and people to make the impossible possible. I'm Asif Mogul, Senior Industry Manager at Autodesk, and each week I'll be joined by two experts from the design and manufacturing world to discuss their perspectives on the challenges our industry faces and share what they're doing to overcome them. From smart products, mass customization, digitization, supply chain resilience, and the convergence of once diverse industries, this podcast is for anyone that runs a design and manufacturing business who's interested in making things possible. You can subscribe by following us on Apple, Spotify, or via your favorite platform. Hi, and welcome to the podcast. Now, a super favorite topic of mine, innovation. It's surely got to be part of every strategy for design and manufacturing companies that I certainly talk to. And it makes sense because if you get it right, the rewards can be actually quite dramatic. Similarly, if you get it wrong, the risks can be equally scary. Now, the interesting thing about digital is it has a role to play in enabling innovation, but without a culture of innovation, without your people, could you really still be successful? And what role does culture play in enabling innovation? And how do you hardwire that sort of culture into your organization and make it last? Well, that's the topic of today. And we're going to be exploring that with my two awesome guests, Kim Dabbs, who's the Global VP of Social Innovation at Steelcase, and they're a leading office furniture manufacturer, and Dylan Horvath, who's a founder and president of Cortex Design, a full-service design and manufacturing company whose ethos is to create human-centric design solutions. So welcome to you both.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Kim, maybe we could start with you. Could you tell us a little bit about Steelcase and your role in the company?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Steelcase, as you were talking about, is a company that leading organizations have trusted over 100 years really to help them build the future of work and those work experiences. We look at our role as creating those dynamic places that help unlock the promise of their people. My role is really focusing on how that happens and then to all of our stakeholders, including the communities where we live and work. I have the great pleasure of working with multiple different teams throughout the globe on really designing and defining those cultures of innovation and those cultures of belonging that helps people thrive.
Thanks, Kim. I love that phrase, unlock the promise of your people. So Dylan, maybe if I could come to you now, your mission is to create products with human-centric design. I found that a really interesting way to describe what you do. Could you tell us a little bit about Cortex and kind of expand on that, please?
For sure. Yep. So Cortex is a full-service product design firm. I founded it over 20 years ago. As a way to get away from the work that I was doing that was more in robotics and actually didn't involve people very much at all. And I realized that the work that I was really interested in doing had that human connection. And industrial design was a big discovery of mine back then. So finding ways to have technology be sympathetic, empathetic with the people that are using it is where my interests really lie. So Cortex Design does that. We identify clients who are launching products that have a strong human-centered focus. We're looking for products that solve tangible human pain points and creating the version of that product that is most successful in the commercial space. So we try to communicate that with all of our potential clients. We try to communicate that with our employees and with the vendors that we use, so that we have that consistency.
Great, thank you. So I think this is going to be a great discussion. I'm certainly looking forward to it. So let's kick it off. So Kim, maybe we could start with you. You do hear a lot about the links between innovation and people, culture, humans, the things that are like non-technological. And building a culture of innovation does seem like it could be a monumental task, especially if you've got a large organization, the sort of organization that Steelcase is. Where on earth do you start?
That's a great question. I think it's a mindset of every single person within the organization and understanding the complex systems that create a culture. We look at that as what are the experiences that we can consistently design around the globe that actually bring out and leverage these beautiful human behaviors that can create the foundation where innovation can thrive. So our role is really understanding those leverage points and those opportunities to have consistency in the rituals that we design and the behaviors that are emerging from those rituals, understanding that it's not going to be the same everywhere. The rituals that happen in Hong Kong are not going to be the same ones that happen in London and New York and San Francisco and all of these different cities. We have a similar human experience. We share many of the same values of why we're working together at Steelcase to accomplish these goals. But having that local control of designing those rituals and seeing how those habits emerge is a really beautiful part of that process. And from those, weaving together those cultural elements that make up your values.
So what I heard there, Kim, was really this: start with the human being at the center of the problem. What behaviors do you want to bring out of them? And I guess there's a sense of almost trusting the fact that the people have got the talents that you need them to demonstrate, but you just need to create an environment to bring those talents, and I think you call them beautiful behaviors, out.
Absolutely.
Sounds amazing. Dylan, I mean, you're talking about human-centric design. From what Kim is saying, is that sort of transferred directly into the kind of almost the approach you take when you're designing products for your clients and customers? Are there similarities or differences?
For sure. Yeah, actually, it's really interesting trying to put myself in Kim's shoes as she's speaking, because I think the cool thing about the built environment, when you are directly designing the things that are going to go into someone's environment, you have this great opportunity to influence human experience. So from our perspective, that is what we look for in the types of products that we design as well. We think about how a person would ideally experience the solution that this product has to offer. And sometimes that experience can be completely transparent. Like a lot of people don't want to interact with products. If it's a monitoring system, or it's a diagnostic system, it's a medical procedure, ideally they're not having an experience with that product at all. So in hardware design, there's a real opportunity then for hardware to do a lot of the things that people don't want to do themselves. That can be an experience in and of itself. And then on the flip side, there's providing delightful experiences that aren't possible without a product, or aren't possible without a piece of furniture, or aren't possible without a system that's in place. So we try to understand the culture of the people that are going to be using this product or using this solution, and we really think of products as solutions. They have to provide a value that is useful, or provide a superpower, or ideally reduce pain, reduce discomfort when we're talking about medical procedures. So understanding the people that are intended to use this product is really the first step. And if we're working with a client that hasn't thought about that, that's the first thing that we start to put together as a scope of work.
Oh, I love what you said there about understanding. So Kim, I wanted to sort of come back to you. How do you start understanding these human beings that are part of your team? Where does that process start? I suppose some people might see it as, hey, let's sit down in a, well, we can't sit down in a room together fully yet, but you would kind of sit down and have shared experience. But where does the understanding start? What is the start of that process?
Yeah, I think you can take a look at that at multiple different altitudes or multiple different levels of immersion and engagement. I think of at the individual level. So just me as a Korean-born American adoptee that lives in Germany. Like, what type of identities do I show up to work with every single day? And how does that impact or interact with the environment that I'm in? How do I feel like I belong? And then when you think about that and how you're showing up in the world and how you can bring your authentic self into the workplace, what does that mean to foster that for an entire team? And what are those norms that you're going to come together around a team to say, this is our culture that we want to have collectively as a team, and this is how we're going to show up for each other to make sure that we can ensure that authenticity is going to thrive. So for my team on social innovation, we work collectively and together, and some of those norms are really taking time to listen and communicate openly, experimentation without fear, things like how we communicate, like challenging ideas and not people, creating that psychological safety within the team, and then ensuring that when we come together as a collective, that we're using our power to actually share power. So how are we being accountable to the communities that we serve? How are we building with community and not for community? And these are the things that really set the dynamic of how a team is going to show up, not only authentically as an individual, but authentically for each other. And then when you know and take time to not only design those norms, but have those present in multiple repeated interactions, those rituals that you've designed, then how do you actually scale that throughout multiple teams? And how are they pointing towards that same North Star? So when I think about designing those things, it's fundamentally creating the cultures of belonging, the cultures of psychological safety, to be able to bring your best self and show up as your best self every single day.
That's really inspirational, Kim. It's made me think of another question I wanted to ask, was this fundamentally feels like it can only be driven from the top down. It's got to be something that the leadership of any company, whether you're a very large organization or even maybe a smaller organization, without that leadership buy-in, I guess things will fail. I mean, how important is it to have leadership right behind this kind of this fundamental shift?
I think it's critical. And I almost look at this as a movement instead of a mandate. Of course, like, you have to have that C-suite buy-in. You have to have that leadership values actually presented in all of those processes that you've designed. But this is where it all starts to come together when you think about workplace or workplace design or the work experience design. So if we're understanding we want that culture of innovation, and in order to have innovation thrive, you need that culture of trust and authenticity. You need those micro interactions where you're not navigating some of that friction. But you also need the process and tools in place to ensure that that culture is resilient enough to be able to function day to day. And those are those things that you're talking about, the rigor within the system. And then for a place like Steelcase, it's what is the space design in order to ensure that all of that culture, process, and tools can function collectively. So when we think about our leadership spaces, instead of being on the 25th floor of a high tower building, they're actually on the first floor in a main heavily trafficked area. Because we believe in order to have that culture of innovation, in order to transfer that trust, you need to be present and in the midst of entire teams so you can get constant feedback, so you can be engaged in a way that is collective and collaborative instead of exclusive and the other.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kim. So Dylan, I suppose where you're coming from is, I guess you must have clients coming to you and saying, hey, I've got this idea or a product I'd like to rehash, redevelop, or completely new sort of concept. So you're coming at it from a more designing an experience around a product. When you're in that process, it's a kind of a two-part question. What does that process look like? And could you talk us through what that process is like? But secondly, the management of these companies or customers or clients that you work with, how clued in are they to their sort of wider context around innovation, creating an innovative environment for their employees to kind of survive and thrive? So kind of a two-part question. I know that's cheating, but sorry for that.
Well, we obviously don't get involved in the environment or the operations necessarily of the clients that we work with. However, what we try to do is explain what our philosophy is before a client even walks in the door. So what we find is we tend to have some resonance and some belief in a common set of values with the clients that we do work with to begin with. And I think that's important. If those operating principles and core values are a surprise that's introduced later on in a project, you can run into trouble. And I think what I've learned over the course of my career is it's best just to be upfront, honest with what we believe to be valuable and true, and where we're willing to flex and where we think there's opportunity and where our curiosity lies. right from the get-go. But there definitely is a duality and sometimes competing agendas when you are thinking about a product or a service that you're delivering versus your own internal culture. And you know, the internal work culture has to be consistent with that, with what it is that you're saying you believe in for the products that you launch. And I think that that's a challenge as well, making sure that the staff and all of the stakeholders that are within an organization also feel the same way, and have those common set of beliefs. And I think in designing, you know, one of the real challenges that we had over the past couple of years, of course, same challenge that everyone had. You can set up an environment that is really wonderful for your staff to work in and be successful in, and then what happens when everybody has to go home? And you know, what are the things that scale well to working from home, and what things do you lose? And like a sense of collaboration in some ways was really well amplified. It became very easy to connect with anyone at a moment's notice, or arrange groups of meetings remotely. But what we lost was all of those like micro interactions, which, you know, only recently, now that we've been able to start filtering back into the office, you get a sense of what you did lose from gaining it back. So it's really interesting to have the benefit of having gone completely remotely and had to use all of these other tools to promote your culture, and then trying to integrate that now into a balance when people are starting to work together again in the same space.
So almost a sense of there's an old saying, isn't it? You don't really value what you've got until you lose it, and so now we're getting it back. I think this feels like there's a sense that we're appreciating these simple things that maybe we took for granted before, and maybe sort of, you know, just respect them a bit more. So Kim, I mean, I guess you must have faced similar challenges in your role when you were started the journey to this kind of new mindset. Could you share with us some of the sort of challenges that you faced, and maybe some of the things you did to overcome them?
Yeah, what a time we're living in. I mean, this pandemic has reshaped so many different aspects of our lives. How we work, where we work, who our teams are, what that home office looks like. And then the reintegration, what happens when people are actually returning to the office in that new culture. So many teams have only worked hybrid, or only worked remotely during this time. And now they're actually coming back into an established culture that was there and existed before they even joined the company. So we're seeing that happen as well. So I think the needs and expectations of everyone are shifting. I think some things that everyone consistently asks for is to be safe and to feel safe. And safety means a lot of different things and in a lot of different places, whether that be mindfulness, mental health, well-being, or if that means things like how many people work in a specific space. But the thing that I'm always fascinated by is that sense of belonging. What does that deeper sense of belonging mean? And how has isolation actually impacted teams and individuals and the way that they work? Yes, we've been able to collaborate in new and different ways. At the same time, I look at these as fundamental equity issues. I work in multiple communities throughout the globe where a home office isn't a viable working condition, where even things like access to internet is not a fundamental right. So when you think about all of those barriers to opportunity and how you start to build in equity and access to opportunity, how are we thinking about that when we think of not just the process and the tools of how work happens, but what are the cultures and the communities that are having to participate in this, and who's not given that equal access? And these are the things that we work at every single day through a social innovation lens.
Dylan, this conversation seems to be revolving around this sort of concept of really being mindful about designing an experience for your, let's just say, your customer. I don't mean that in the sort of the commercial sense, but your stakeholders. So if you're a leadership in a position or an employer, then maybe your customers are your your staff that work in the business, and in your context, your customers or clients or the people that come to you for advice. It seems to be around designing an experience. How much of that do you think it really is understood amongst the people that come to you? Do they come to you and say, look, I just want this product, I want this pen, it's got to be X, Y, and Z, and it's got to be Wi-Fi connected? But do they really get the sort of broader context and the importance of designing the experience of maybe how somebody finds that pen amongst all the thousands of pens that are available on the internet, how they could purchase it, how it gets to them, how they unbox it, which Apple were very famous for, weren't they? Sort of creating that experience of almost like it's unwrapping treasure. Is that fairly well understood amongst, you know, the people that you work with?
It is. And however, everyone has a different set of tools that they come to work with in terms of their own experience and their own ability to operate and deliver on something like that. And also the scope of the project limits what we can do in many cases. We're not working with Apple-sized budgets generally. So probably if someone came to us with the idea for a Wi-Fi-enabled pen, we would point out all of the new experiences you were going to have if you had a Wi-Fi-enabled pen.
And you'd laugh them out of the room, probably, yeah.
You know, we could talk later about whether or not that's a good product. But, you know, those are some of the things that we try to do right off the top of the bat. Understand, okay, if we're visualizing living with the solution, how does that work? And then, you know, the challenge, especially when we're all working remotely, is having a cohesive sense of that and having enough conversations around that we understand what it is that we're trying to do within the constraints of the project. Constraints are useful because they help you get something done. We do have to work within a framework of what a client believes is successful and what they need to get to the next point in their business. It definitely helps. I think that most clients that come to us have a belief that human-centered product design is important, but they may not have experienced it directly themselves of how that happens and what the process for developing a human-centered product might be. So those are things that we bring to them.
Could you maybe just go into a little bit more detail about human-centric? Because I'm just wondering if anyone who's listening may not have heard that term before. Could you just explain a little bit more about what is human-centric design?
Sure. And, you know, it probably means a little bit something different to everyone who speaks about it. So I can tell you what it means to me. What I believe is that when we are living in a physical world and we have to interact with physical things in our life continually. And some of those things we notice and some of the things we don't. A lot of the times the things that we notice are the things that irritate us. And when we are asked to use something that's new in our environment, we're coming at it from the world of things that we've known to interact with in the past. So if we're now being given a new, let's use the case of we designed a medication dispensing system, and the idea of the medication dispensing system was around increasing the ability of someone to adhere to a medication schedule that may be new to them. You know, it's something that challenges a lot of people when they are diagnosed with a chronic human health condition, and all of a sudden part of their life becomes having a whole bunch of medication. And it's probably a slow burn up to that point. You know, there may be one medication 1 year and then a second one gets added the next year, and all of these things are at different schedules. So the standard of care in a lot of long-term care facilities, for example, is that a person actually comes to the door and administers the proper medication at the proper time and sits with the person and makes sure that happens. If you're in a long-term care facility, it tends to be because you have reached a point where you can no longer do the things that you need to do to keep yourself healthy. So this medication dispensing system that we developed, it's called Carry, a nice approachable name. It has a bit of a personality. And one of the things that we look for is a way to integrate that product into a person's life, so it's not a big burden on their experience. You know, you don't really want to think about what your medication schedule is. You don't want to take it in the first place. So this system is looks like anything that would belong in your on your desk or on your kitchen counter or a coffee center. And it will remind you when it's time to take your next medication. And all you have to do is go over there and push a button, and the button's lit up to say, this is the one you want to push. There is only one button, so you can really only interact with it one way. And it will dispense a pouch of medication that is for you to take at that time and actually even pre-tear it for you. And all you have to do is take it and swallow it. And so that's a philosophy of design that that we took very early on, that we didn't want this to be something that you would have to have a caregiver bring in to refill, for example. The cartridges come pre-filled and you just take one out and you put the next one in. So we try to make the barrier to entry for the types of new behavioral changes to be minimal. And if they are a behavior change, you want to make them things that they have done before. So pushing a lit button, relatively straightforward. Most people have had that experience, taking a cartridge out of something and putting it back in, making sure that the form of that indicates that it's something to be pulled. You know, understanding what the affordances are in design that let people know how to interact with something. You know, like a doorknob is a good example. You know, if you have a flat panel, that's a push. If it's a handle, that's a twist. If it's a knob, it's a twist. So you try and think of all these things that will help guide and minimize the changes to an experience.
So you really are putting yourself in the shoes of the person, in your case, that will be using the product, and trying to eliminate sort of all doubt or uncertainty, just making it sort of a painless, maybe even a sort of a pleasant experience, even if it might be an experience related to taking medication. So really putting yourself in the shoes of that person.
That's right.
What's the smoothest, painless experience we can design for them? And this is why I like really, really like the sort of term design of the experience, because it's much more than just a product, isn't it? It's much more than just an injection molded piece of plastic with some smart sensors and buttons on it. It's putting some, almost being mindful about how it might be used. So I think that's what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, absolutely. And with healthcare products, you really want to reduce the stigma of their existence in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, the fact that this thing is in your living environment now means that people are going to see it when they come over. You have guests over, they're going to see whatever you have there. And so you don't want it to speak too loudly. You don't want it to suggest something about the person that they don't want to live or that they don't want to own. You know, people buy products for a multitude of reasons. One of the reasons is to solve a pain point, but like when you go out and buy a watch, you can tell people, well, I need to buy a watch to tell the time. Chances are that's actually not really the reason why you're buying a watch. You know? you can tell the time pretty easily with a phone now. So people who are wearing watches are buying that watch to speak to the world about how they want to be viewed. And so when you purchase a product, if you have any product come into your life, it has to be sympathetic and has to empathize with how that person wants to be viewed and how that person wants to live. And you know, we can't be so presumptuous to assume that we understand that from the get-go. You know, the people that work at Cortex all come from their lived experiences, which are limited. And as are mine. So I don't know what it's like to live in a long-term care facility. So we don't presume to understand that. We do initial ethnographic discovery when we're looking at a target market of interest. So in that case, it's really important for there to be an approach of openness and discovery and listening rather than trying to take someone on a guided tour of what you want, you know, what your agenda is. Oh, well, wouldn't it be great if you had this? That's a leading question that's going to result in poor data.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of leading the witness.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's exactly what it's like. So you want to go into these environments with a philosophy of openness and discovery and curiosity, so that you can actually find those little insights and make the people that you're speaking with feel safe enough to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Kim, I liked what you were saying about that sense of security that you want to foster within an organization, because it's only from that sense of security and safety that people can feel free to truly be open. You know, when we're visiting with a new client and we get taken to a boardroom, that's generally the first bad sign, right? We ask to get out of that boardroom immediately. That's not where the product is going to be. That's not where the development happens. That's not where the customer is. So, you know, you need to feel safe enough to be open and be in the right environment and to share a true experience with the rest of the people that you're speaking with. And if you don't have that safety and security, you can't be open, and then you can't be truthful.
I love that. I always think about that as the transfer of trust. It's in between our teams and between employees. How does that transfer of trust actually take place? And for you, especially in that design process, you hear about that, of just like really taking caution and care of the trust that's been placed in your hands as you're designing those new things, whether they be medical or not. But it's critical. Curiosity was one of our key tenets as we were building the Learning and Innovation Center here in Munich, as well as in our culture and in our process, which really does embed that trust. Because you can't collaborate with authenticity without that trust. I think about those things happening in the physical world. I liked how you had talked about our relationship with the physical world and noticing those things or those elements. A lot of times when people walk into a workplace, you can tell what kind of culture they have almost instantly by how their space is organized, because you know what types of behaviors that's starting to nudge. And even, you know, one of the things I always notice is when you go into these work environments where they have beautiful, beautiful spaces, but no one's utilizing them. And you'll see this one person in a work cafe or on a sofa on their laptop, and the boss is like, oh, they're not doing work. When you know that the amazing work is happening in that moment, how they're resting, rejuvenating, how the well-being is being internalized, maybe their best work is actually done on a sofa in that space with a colleague. And that's where that happens. So when we think about these assumptions that we come into, when you actually take that human-centric or that human-centered approach by just observation and seeing how devices are designed or utilized, but also how workplaces are designed to actually influence and foster that culture of, hey, are we performative? Are we showing that we want to be this way and have these social cues of innovation? Or do you actually have the culture that has the process and tools embedded in it to really say, oh, I trust my employees to be working in this space or this space, understanding that all of that actually leads to that innovation mindset?
Kim, I was going to ask a question about scaling, but I'm just wondering whether we've stumbled upon this now. You're both talking about trust. Do you think trust is the secret ingredient to... Because you see a lot of examples of companies with the best will in the world wanting to do some kind of cultural change to become more innovative as a company. So, you know, innovation around how their people show up to work, which hopefully leads on to innovation in terms of like new business ideas or product ideas. And there's lots of great examples where companies have started this process, but they kind of die really quickly. Is trust the kind of secret sauce to kind of keep this thing going? Could it be as simple as that? Trust your people, create the right environment, and this thing will start to scale and scale and scale? Or is there a different secret sauce?
I think it's a yes and. I think trust is key and critical, of course, but you can only have trust if your actions are actually a reflection of the values that you've espoused. So you can place those values, you can see them, how they manifest in behavior throughout space. You can understand them in the products that they designed and how they're designed through an environmental, social, or governance lens. Like, do you actually have the rigor within your system to make those good choices, which then embeds the trust in the entire process? But at the individual level, if they don't see themselves in that entire system and find that individual purpose within that daily work, it all is going to start to dissipate, or it's all going to start to fall apart. And I think that trust is around like delivering on that promise that you've given to employees of the culture and the values that you have. See it represented in how you design, what you design, and then authentically create the culture where employees can find their individual purpose in the work that they do every single day.
Yeah, trust is definitely a component, but Kim, I think you said living that experience too, and really it comes down to actual examples, right? Like, this is what happened when we designed this table. And one of the things that I trust is that people are going to make mistakes, sometimes right. ones that are very critical. And that's not a great thing. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you know, all of our work was error-free and didn't involve any mistakes at all, and we were just perfect? Well, you know, one of the things that I trust is that no one's perfect. So one of the things that I think we need to be aware of within our own system of designing this company is that we need to trust that in order to move forward, it has to be okay to make mistakes, and it has to be okay for a person to be given that trust and then feel like they betrayed it because, you know, they went off the deep end, down some development path that bore no fruit, or, you know, they instructed the manufacturer to do something that ended up being an error. It's how we recover from those things that allow people to feel safe, and the examples that we can point to and learn from and transmit and amplify around the company when, especially in growth mode, when like you're getting a lot of new staff those experiences, they're bringing in all sorts of new experiences that you haven't had time yet to understand or vet. And, you know, their way of operating may be different than what you expected. So I think it's really critical to be aware of that as a leader and design a way in which those behaviors can be accepted, amplified, improved. But it does come down to tangible examples and not just words, right?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Because you could have a slogan, you know, or your sort of core mission statement on the wall of your office. And if an employee or member of your team comes in and something happens, you know, boss, I've made a terrible mistake, genuinely. And you sort of, you don't demonstrate what's being written on the wall behind you. Then, of course, that trust, your authenticity, that credibility is killed instantly, isn't it? And that employee, if it was me, I'd leave the room thinking, wow, that person certainly doesn't believe what they're telling me to do. So I think there's a critical point around trusting them to fail and just kind of just demonstrating that trust in as many ways as you possibly can.
Absolutely. I think, Dylan, like when you bring that up too, I think one of the things that's I think a skill that's been undertrained for and maybe not scaled as globally as we'd like it in our cultures today, it's in order to build that trust, you need to have and flex that muscle of civil discourse. And in order to have that psychological safety there, if you want diversity on a team, and if you want that inclusion to happen, in order for people to feel safe, you have to have two opposing viewpoints come together, be able to talk and reconcile what that is, and still walk away and agree to disagree, but have that healthy discourse. And like, where are those productive tensions within a culture, and how are those actually played out in time? Otherwise, we're talking about just toxic positivity, right? It's just not going to happen in any culture. But how civil discourse shows up, how that's embedded, and how you coach leaders and teams to actually have those tough conversations. And I think once you do that, and especially within design, I would say like the design field has a little more muscle there to be able, the way that they're trained through different charrettes and different schooling to have those tough conversations. But I think holistically, as you bring a culture together, like how do people actually disagree?
I love that phrase, toxic positivity. That's
really good. It's bizarre. I read it somewhere recently, the term, you know, positivity. Actually, I think it's an audio book by, so I probably can't mention it because I'm plugging it. But yeah, I think positivity, you can have too much positivity and it can get into the toxic realm. So it's not just a case of constantly being positive about something. I think that your point about it is okay to disagree. Some people call it disagree but commit, or just disagree, agree to disagree. It's a normal part of how humans should interact without sort of taking things personally. And I think that's a great way to foster that sense of trust, and always demonstrating the examples, Dylan, you talked about. So I went in and disagreed with my boss. We had a really cool conversation about it. And at the end of the day, he said, okay, well, we're off down to grab a coffee. Let's go. And there was no hard feelings about it. So I can't imagine a more powerful way to make someone feel I can really say what's on my mind, and you know, without fear of recriminations or that kind of stuff. So,
and it has to take place at the right time too. One of the things that we do as a regular part of our business is we conduct sandbox sessionals, and in those sessionals, part of what we're doing is, you know, we're playing in a sandbox. There's no rules in the sandbox. You can build anything. You can design anything. You can. It's free from constraint, and part of that joy of designing in that, you know, free from constraint areas, there are no bad ideas. And you probably heard this in terms of like thinking creatively in some of these tools, but it's good to have a few rules. And one of the rules that we have is you can only take down your own ideas in those sessions. You can criticize your own ideas. And everyone else's job in those sandbox sessionals is to amplify someone else's idea. Try to understand like the nugget of what it was that they were hoping to suggest or hoping to promote. You may personally feel it's a bad idea, but your job is using your wealth of knowledge and using your own personal experiences to take that the essence of that idea and try to make it just a little bit better. And then for your own ideas, be open about your fears and your uncertainties about, you know, maybe that's not the greatest idea, but I said it anyway.
That's a great example. Maybe my Wi-Fi enabled pen, there might be some hope for it.
At the essence, you're trying to do something positive with that Wi-Fi enabled pen. So, you know, what is it? What's the little nugget that we really
want to... We'll have to get into that at another time. But I wanted to kind of sort of switch to, because a lot of people that will be listening to this, we call them sort of, you know, small to medium-sized businesses or enterprises. Maybe there's some larger organizations. And they'll be listening to what we're talking about and be saying, oh, yeah, it's okay for Steelcase and Cortex, or the size of organizations they are and that kind of stuff. But I'm just a tiny little company out in the middle of nowhere. What would be the benefit? So I just wondered if you could share with us, you know, without giving away anything too, you know, commercially sensitive, the impacts of you adopting the cultures of innovation inside your companies now. I'm not talking about sort of, Dylan, from your point of view, from your clients, the products you develop for them, but what are the impacts have been on your businesses of just switching your mindset to this kind of approach? Kim, could you kick us off?
Yeah, that's a great one. I always think of that in different sizes of organizations that we work with, both from the community standpoint, really tiny, like 3-person organizations, all the way up to the multinationals with hundreds of thousands of employees throughout the world. And I think as we embedded that culture of innovation within our own places and spaces, what it does is it really focuses more on mindsets than it does on individual skill. And the innovation culture and the learning culture have to be not only side by side, but 100% integrated. Exactly like Dylan was talking about, we need to make sure that people are learning and growing. They're not going to get everything right all the time, and we learn and we push those boundaries. But in our example, in the past couple of years, think about how much the world has changed in the blink of an eye, in multiple locations, multiple geographies. And in order for an institution to pivot so quickly, or to turn, or to shift, or to change, and be able to be responsive, if the processes override the agility, you're not going to be able to write that. And like, I think of the last 2 years as truly pressure testing values of an organization. Do you say you're an organization that has an innovation culture, but when pressure tested, it was super hierarchical and there was no way for us to shift or change our methods, how we were actually doing business. And if you have that innovation mindset, if you have the ability to help your teams, empower them to make distributed decisions at the point of need in big, large companies. When you have a disruption like we've had in the past couple of years, you're able to shift and change and move along with that. Doesn't mean it's easy, but it does give you that chance to be able to know that the future is unknown and we're going to have to make and continuously adapt to a changing ecosystem, landscape, environment, whatever that may be. And that innovation culture, it's not just on the product side, and it's not just on the services they're delivering, but internally, that innovation culture will help them interact with each other in a safe way. And that safety is needed when you're turning something really quickly.
I guess, you know, you've experienced that at Steelcase with everything that's happened over the last. So I think that what I'm hearing you say is that the benefit is the agility that you've got built into the organization allowed you to respond to something awful that happened that we all know about, and you know, just keep going and find a new direction. In fact, in many ways, sort of thrive. If I hear you right, Dylan, what about from your context of actual of Cortex Design? If we put the context of the work you do for your clients to kind of one side and just think about your business and your people, what are some of the benefits you've seen that have come out of a result of having this mindset, this innovative culture, you know, some of the things you described, the benefits to you as a business?
Well, the benefits are when that process really resonates with a client and they're shown something that they didn't consider that results in a good business outcome for them. Lets them hit that next milestone in their business, lets them win the next funding round. You know, a lot of our work is about increasing resonance along the product development path of something that's never been seen before. So when we're able to run through a successful process and those clients receive a concept for their product that is very different than what they were envisioning at the beginning and is better because of A, B, or C, and they're able to show that to their stakeholders and they're able to land their next, you know, $5 million funding round. Those are tangible outcomes of a successful process. And those are the things that we're paid to do. You know, I've been thinking about how the staff at Cortex and Cortex as an organization, we're a team of professionals and we're paid to win. So that is our task. We can promote a certain culture within, but ultimately, what is our job as the C-suite for the organization is to make sure that we're adding the team members that can feel safe, can perform well, but ultimately have a performance mentality around solving problems for the clients that we work for, and we want that game that we play to be fun. We want them to enjoy it because they're good at it. We want them to get the coaching that they need in order to excel. We need to put them into the roles and the positions that they're most effective at. And hopefully all of our onboarding, all of our training, all of this works out. There also has to be an acceptance that not everyone's going to be along for that same journey. And sometimes you have to make a hard decision about who's on the team.
So we're getting to the sort of last bit of the conversation. And this is where I'd like you to both imagine that every single leader of every single design and manufacturing company is listening to you both. And they're asking you for advice. And so what would be the one piece of advice you would give to a leader in a business that's thinking about, like, you know, I think I'm really struggling with the culture of innovation in my business. I think I'd really like to take it seriously. I wonder what's the first thing I could do. So Kim, maybe we could sort of start with you. What advice would you give, you know, anyone who's in a leadership position struggling with this culture of innovation? Where should they start?
I think any business, any organization, if they're going to have an impact in the world, financial, non-financial, or otherwise, building a culture is key and critical to anyone's success. And you need just as much prioritization around the culture and that experience or the work experience as any other type of measurable or deliverable that you have within your organization. I think those companies that actually prioritize cultures of innovation, of belonging, of authenticity are going to be the ones that have the long-term impact and outperform many others. And you're seeing that through all of the ESG research that's happening throughout the world. And we live in a beautiful moment in time where these topics are actually happening in the boardrooms, in the C-suite, as well as around lunchroom tables. So we have a great opportunity to deliver on that promise every single day.
Great. Thank you, Kim. So it's all about culture. Dylan, what advice would you give?
I would say be ready to be vulnerable and show that you understand that all of your choices may not be the best ones, but you have to make them, and these are the ones that you're making. Being vulnerable is also about being ready to accept change and understand that everyone is bringing something to the table and bringing something to the organization. And that should be an integral part of the way the organization moves forward, as opposed to a top-down hierarchy where what you say goes at the cost of all other decisions or input. So being vulnerable, being willing to listen to the leaders within the organization and all the way down to the most junior of your staff, what their ideas are and how they can contribute to bringing your company forward.
Fantastic. Two superb bits of advice there. So I've got it's the usual thing. I've got to try and summarize everything I've learned from this great conversation that I've had with you both. So here goes, and you feel free to give me marks out of 10 if you like. But I think what I've heard you both say is, what's been great about this podcast is we haven't mentioned a single piece of digital technology. And it just kind of, it's the underlying message that I'm taking from this conversation is that innovation doesn't start with technology. That could be an enabler, but it's the result of the right people and culture. And you know, fostering that culture of innovation is absolutely indispensable if you want to bring disruptive ideas, incrementally innovative ideas, lots of incrementally innovative ideas together. What I think we're saying is, treat it as a journey or a movement. It's not a tick box exercise. And then if you start with that as a premise, then your mindset as a leader has to be around, look, I trust my people and I know they've got the right skills. And my job is to unlock the promise of my people, which Kim, I think you said that was a beautiful phrase. And then embark on this design journey, design a human-centric culture where you lead with curiosity and understanding. You understand the environments you're asking your people to show up in and do their job or demonstrate their expertise. You have that environment where they can fail and just be supported and trusted. And also kind of have some way of continually monitoring how it's going. Don't just set things up and kind of just expect it to work. But really put yourself in their shoes and empower them. Empower them to be the best they can be. And if we get those things right, we'll lead to some of the tangible benefits that we talked about, the agility of the organization. And I don't think anybody on the planet would disagree that agility in this industry is critical. And we've just seen how unagile we have been 2 years ago. I think that the pandemic's put a spotlight on that. But also I think it just makes you stand out as an organization, stand out as completely different to your clients, your customers. If we're talking about the people outside of the organization. And as somebody on the receiving end of that, I can't help thinking that that difference would be absolutely one of the things that will make people kind of loyal to your brand and loyal to your company. So I kind of think that's what I've heard. Let me just check in with you both in terms of, do you think I've missed anything? Have we missed anything? Kim, I'll come to you first.
I think that was a beautiful summary. I think it hit on all of those key components along the journey.
Thank you very much. Dylan, how about you? Is there anything to add?
Well, you know, I think we want to write a simple story. So having something that people can really understand and communicate with each other in terms of a mission and being able to articulate that mission internally and externally, I think is a really key piece of any business.
Great shout. So, you know, be clear about your mission or your purpose and the things that you value, and then sort of use that much further earlier in the sort of steps that I mentioned. So, as always, I really hope that if you've been listening, that today's conversations maybe challenged you in the right way, maybe brought up a few golden nuggets of things that you could try or best practices that you could explore. At the very least, kicked off a conversation you might have with your colleagues in the leadership team about how you could build your own cultures of innovation. So all that's left for me to do is thank my guests from today's episode, Kim Dabbs of Steelcase and Dylan Horvath of Cortex Designs. And thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time on the next episode.